We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Well, thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
Welcome to Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. This is our new podcast from the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. We're going to be doing this podcast once per week, and we're going to be talking about all things elections, how elections are supposed to work, how they are not supposed to work, what happened in 2020, what we think should happen in 2021 and 22, and what you can do about it if you're concerned about the state of America's elections. I want to talk just a little bit at first about CPI, the Conservative Partnership Institute. It was founded by former United States Senator Jim DeMint as a platform to help build and strengthen the conservative movement and to support the fundamental principles on which our country was founded. We were joined this year by former Congressman and former White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, who is the senior partner at Conservative Partnership Institute. And I joined Conservative Partnership Institute this year as the senior legal fellow for election integrity. And our goal through CPI is to build a platform for building a national infrastructure for election integrity. And that's what this podcast is all about. It's about helping you as a citizen, as a patriot, as a conservative, as an American who may be independent and not have strong political views, but I would wager that if you're listening to this podcast or watching this podcast, you do have some strong political views. But you know that the system that we witnessed in 2020 was not right. And I'm going to share stories with you about my experiences in 2020. We're going to have other people from around the country, from different states, who are going to be guests on this podcast, who are going to talk to you about what happened in their states in 2020 and what they're doing about it now. There are activities, formal proceedings going on across the country. We're going to be talking about each and every one of those. We're going to be talking about Congress and the horrible things the Democrats in Congress are trying to get done that would forever wreck our election system. So we're gonna have a lot of fun on this podcast. At least I think it's fun. A little bit about myself is I'm an elections junkie. From the time I was a little girl in Oklahoma, growing up in Oklahoma City, I would say to my mom, "Don't go vote until I get home from school," because I always wanted to go to the polls with my mother to vote. And I studied the candidates, and I always wanted to actually be part of the process on election day. One of the problems I will tell you that I consider to be a huge challenge for us in America today is that we no longer have election day. We now have election season. We have election 2 months. So we're going to be talking about some of those kinds of things, structural changes that I think have negatively impacted our election system. But I have been an election attorney for many, many years. I've done a lot of time at county election boards. I will tell you that I've spent many wee hours in the morning counting ballots, waiting for ballots to come in. I've never seen what happened in 2020 happen before November 3rd of 2020, where the counting stopped before it was finished. That was, I've certainly been in county election offices or state election offices where we were waiting for some county to get its counting done and send it its results to the state or the central counting office, but I've never seen an actual halting of the counting of the ballots. That's one of the things that we're going to be exploring in this podcast. But I've been the chairman, national co-chair of the Republican National Lawyers Association, and also the president of the national organization. And our goal and what I've done in that regard is working on what are the checks and balances for involving people, in that case, lawyers, to watch the proceedings as the elections are unfolding. And I've written an Election Day Operations Manual. Like I say, Election Day Operations is still the term that the RNC uses, and it's like high-button shoes. It should be election season operations, not Election Day. And so I'm going to be talking about a lot of these different things, but I think I'm going to start with my experiences in 2020. On the day after the election, I was actually in Bozeman, Montana, where I had been for their election day operations preceding on the weekend before an election day. And I've been working with Senator Steve Daines, the Republican senator from Montana, who's a great friend and a great conservative, and the Republican Party of Montana. And I've been working with them for a number of years. And just to put into context what the left started doing well before the election in 2020 was that the lawsuits that the left and Democratic Party entities had filed to challenge Montana's election laws. One of the things that the legislature in Montana had done a couple of years ago in 2018, they had put a referendum on a ballot, on the statewide ballot in Montana, to prohibit ballot harvesting. Ballot harvesting is when people other than a family member or someone known to you collects your ballot, your mail ballot, and turns it in either to a drop box or an election office. And Montana voters, over 63% of the Montana voters, agreed that ballot harvesting should be illegal. And they passed that, the legislature referred it to the people, and the public, the voters, approved it, including the voters on the Indian reservations, who also agreed that ballot harvesting was a bad idea. And they made it illegal. They outlawed it. So into the courts come a citizen, a Native American activist left-wing group, and challenged the application of the ballot harvesting prohibition. But they only challenged its application on the Indian reservations. They didn't challenge it for the rest of Montana. But Montana, like many other places, this may surprise you, has a very liberal judiciary. It's really quite disturbing, and it's very difficult for conservatives or Republicans to get a fair shake in the state courts in Montana. It's true in Washington State. It's true in Oregon. It's true in many places in California. It's true in Austin, Texas, and Fulton County and Philadelphia. We'll be talking about some of those problems as we go forward, but having a fair judiciary is something that I think that we all just assume there is, but I'm just telling you that some of these judicial systems are very highly political, and unfortunately, they tend to be prejudiced against conservatives and against Republicans more than I can't even think of a judicial system anywhere in the country where I would say that it's prejudiced in favor of conservatives. I guess I would think of that as favoring the rule of law, but anyway, this judge ended up granting more than this Native American interest group had even asked for, and prohibited the enforcement of the ballot harvesting law everywhere in the state. They had only asked to have it prohibited on the reservations. And the judge said, well, I'll just make it illegal all over the state to enforce this law that 63% of the voters of Montana had approved. But we had several lawsuits that I had been working with the people in Montana, the party committee and the candidates and Senator Daines. And I think there were four lawsuits in 2020 leading up to the election where the Democrats were challenging various issues and laws that had been enacted. And to tell you that we lost all of those cases. I don't think we won a single case. As I said, the judiciary is very prejudiced, and to get a fair shake in Montana courts is really not, it's really hard if you're a conservative or Republican. But in any event, fortunately, the election was successful, and despite all the tens of millions of dollars that left-wing groups poured into Montana to try to defeat Senator Daines, he was reelected, and every statewide official was Republican, the legislature's Republican, et cetera. So we had a great day on November 3rd, 2020 in Montana. And so on November 4th, I was in my car getting ready, sitting. I'd literally just gotten in my car. I was just putting in the coordinates to get the directions to go to the airport in Bozeman to fly home. And I got a call from Mark Meadows, who was at the time President Trump's chief of staff. And he asked me where I was. And I said I was in Bozeman, Montana. And he asked me if I would go to Atlanta. And so I did. I flew to Atlanta. And thus began my involvement with the post-election, seeing what had happened in Georgia. And I will tell you, it was a very interesting experience because of just the difference in the way things had been handled between what the state party had done in Montana and then going to Georgia. But the first morning I was there, this is a God thing. I'm absolutely, I believe that. I was sitting next to this young man, the first person I met, and he started telling me a little bit about what was going on, what had been going on. And then he started telling me about a project that he and some others had been, he's a young lawyer in Georgia, Alex Kaufman, wonderful young man, who had run for the state house and was one of the candidates who had run for the state house trying to pick up some house seats for Republicans in Fulton County, which is Atlanta. And he told me about a project that they had been working on for nearly a year to identify the number of illegal voters on the rolls in Fulton County that they were had been unable to get removed. And he told me about the project that they where they had sent people out to homes and knocked on the door, and a person would come to the door and they would say, no, John Smith doesn't live here. He hasn't lived here in 20 years, but that's who's still registered to vote there. So they would gather affidavits. They had over 400 affidavits in just four or five house districts in Fulton County of people who said that the person registered to vote at their address did not live there and had not lived there in some time. And so I began to realize as an election lawyer that what we needed to do was to really look carefully at the data as it was coming in to see who had voted, to look at those registrations, to find out if they were really real people, if there were, we needed to compare their records across state lines, and we needed to be able to know whether or not there were illegal votes that were being counted and included in the certified results. And at this time, when I first arrived, there were no certifications. They were still counting. They continued to count for several days. And as we know, as time unfolded, first of all, President Trump was winning Georgia, and then all of a sudden he wasn't winning Georgia. And there were three different certified totals. The final tally was 11,779 votes, 11,779 votes separating President Trump and Joe Biden. And of course, Joe Biden was declared the winner. Well, under Georgia law, if you can establish that there are more illegal votes or irregularities included in the certified number, and you can show that in a court of law, then the remedy is a new election. Well, guess what? Georgia was going to have another election, another statewide election on January the 5th for the two U.S. Senate seats. Now, I will tell you that I believe that Senator David Perdue should never have been in a runoff in the first place, had the votes been properly counted. But he did not contest that. There's some question under the Georgia law whether you have to wait until after the runoff. I don't agree with that. I think he should have contested it the next day because clearly there was a problem. There were irregularities in his race. But I was there to try to look at what was going on with the presidential election. Ultimately, what we did, we called ourselves Team Deplorables. We were volunteers, and we pulled together and put together a lawsuit, an election contest under the Georgia election law. And I will tell you that it is a 64-page complaint filed of record in Fulton County, Georgia, with over 8,000 pages of affidavits and sworn testimony about this illegal vote and that illegal vote and this problem and that problem. And we filed that on December the 4th. And it is supposed to be an expedited proceeding. And we ask for an expedited review because the clock was ticking for the certification of the presidential electors. And under Georgia law, when you sue a constitutional officer, you must bring that lawsuit in Fulton County, which is the capital. And then the chief judge of Fulton County is required by law to then appoint another judge who doesn't reside in the county to actually hear the case. And we kept waiting and waiting for the judge to assign, for the chief judge to assign a judge to hear our case. And the clock is ticking, ticking, ticking. Well, guess what? The chief judge, Chris Brasher, B-R-A-S-H-E-R, for anybody who wants to know his name, he never appointed a judge to hear our case. President Trump never got his day in court in Georgia. And when I talk to reporters and reporters want to tell me that the president lost all of these cases, well, I'll tell you one case he didn't lose, and that was the Georgia lawsuit because it was never heard. We ultimately had to dismiss the case, which we actually were doing the night of January the 6th, because the attorney general on behalf of the Secretary of State of Georgia had threatened that if we did not dismiss the case, that they would seek damages in the multi-millions of dollars against President Trump, against David Schaefer, who was one of our plaintiffs. He's the state party chairman, and he was a Trump elector, and against the lawyers who brought the lawsuit. They were being very helpful, you know. So we dismissed the case, but they also said that if we dismissed all the cases that had been filed, that they would share with us the data and the records that they said conflicted with or repudiated our data. But nonetheless, all I'm telling you is that in Georgia, we followed the law. We filed the case. There was nothing in the lawsuit that was not substantiated by a verified affidavit of a fact witness or a verified affidavit of an expert witness basing a report on available government records. So that's what happened in Georgia. We never got our day in court. And I'll never get over that fact. It never occurred to me that we would spend nights and nights and pull all night, all day, and pull together a solid lawsuit with solid claims, all backed up by verified affidavits, which is like testimony and evidence, and that we'd never get to present that to a court of law and have any sort of adjudication of our claims. So then what has happened in Georgia? Well, let me just say this. I want to say one thing about the Secretary of State. Actually, I want to say a lot about the Secretary of State of Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, who was a complete disaster, not insofar as a partisan looking at it, but just in terms of how he conducted the election or failed to properly conduct the election. He began by agreeing with a lawsuit with Stacey Abrams that that they would make it much more difficult to have signature matching. And that was the only way with this massive increase in absentee mail-in ballots in Georgia, which he helped to create. That's another thing he did. In the spring of 2020, Brad Raffensperger sent to every voter on the active registered voter list an application for an absentee ballot. There was no authority for him to do that. The law in Georgia rightly says that if you want to vote by absentee, you have to ask for the application, and then you have to fill it out, submit it to the Secretary of State or your local county, and receive, and then they will then send you the absentee ballot. But Brad Raffensperger decided on his own to just send 400,000 or 4 million, however many he sent, to everyone on the active voter registration list. And we all know that the voter registration lists are a mess. But I just have mentioned to you the project they had in Atlanta trying to get Fulton County to clean up their rolls, which they wouldn't do. They refused to do before the election. And then they brought a lawsuit, by the way, that project brought a lawsuit to try to get the court to order them to remove these people from the rolls where they had affidavits where people said they did not live, this person doesn't live here. And the judge said, oh, well, it's too close to the election. And she refused to order them to comply with federal and state law. to clean up the voter rolls before the November 3rd election. But Brad Raffensperger, not only did he send out all of those applications for absentee ballots, he also broke the law when he put a check, a place on the absentee ballot application that says, and check here if you'd like to receive an absentee ballot for the general election. Well, the Georgia law says you cannot request an absentee ballot for any election more than 180 days before that election. And now we had over 300,000 applications for absentee ballots for the general election that were requested prior to the statutory date when they could be accepted. So look, I mean, that's a lot of numbers and dates, but the point is, election laws are determined by the state legislatures. That is one of the things that our founding fathers wrote into the Constitution. In Article 2 of the Constitution, it specifically provides that the state legislatures shall determine the time, place, and manner for electing members of Congress. And Congress only has a reserve power to act in the event that the states don't act. And the way that that the states have acted is to then create election codes that apply not just to members of Congress, but to all the elected officials for that particular state. And that's the constitutional process. And my view, and as we were preparing the lawsuit, was if the state legislature, in its judgment, has decided that in order to be a legal ballot, you have to be registered in this manner. You can't be registered at a P.O. box. You have to, if you move out of the county more than 30 days before the election, you lose your ability to go back and vote at your prior address. And on, if the law says this is the way it's supposed to be done, that's the way it is supposed to be done. And if you don't like that, go to the legislature and get it changed. But what the Democrats and their left-wing allies have done is they've gone to judges and gotten laws ignored, or you have judges who refuse to enforce the law, like the judge in Fulton County who refused to remove people from the rolls when they had verified affidavits that they didn't live at their registered address. And when you have a chief judge in Fulton County who refused to appoint a judge to hear the case so that we could get our day in court and adjudicate whether these were or were not legal ballots that were cast. One of the things with Secretary Raffensperger, I just could go on and on. He had his own election monitor review Fulton County before the election and report back that things were a mess there, that they had printed their own ballots. And now those are missing. There are 22,000 ballots that were printed in Fulton County before the election that are now unaccounted for in terms of being a proper chain of custody. And so this is one of many things. Remember, that margin of victory between President Trump and Joe Biden is 11,779 votes. But I want to read you something. Many of you may have seen the video of what happened at State Farm Arena on election night at starting about 10 p.m. And we obtained this video, our team deplorables who were working on the president's behalf, and we obtained this video and sat and watched it through the night and saw what some people had given us affidavits saying, that they were there. They were observing the counting of the ballots on election night, and around 10 p.m., and you can see it on the video, around 10 p.m., that the election officials came and started telling them to leave. And you can see them pack up. You can see the media. You can see all of them packing up and leaving. And the moment they were gone, and you see this on the video, then you had these election workers, the same ones who had run out the observers. Now, mind you, Georgia and every state requires that you have to have observers during observing the process of voting and the process of counting ballots, processing ballots. So they left And immediately, the election officials start pulling these cases of ballots out from under the table and start running them through the tabulators. And there are some who have watched it who say they're running the same ballots through multiple times. And we have had experts try to calculate how many ballots they processed and counted during that period. It was from about 10:25 p.m. on election night through about 12:15 a.m. November the 4th, when they finally stopped. And there has been some estimates, conservative estimates, was that it's 19,000 ballots. But let me just read to you what, well, before I read to you, let me just tell you what Brad Raffensperger's changing explanations about that video have been. The next morning, after we sent someone over to present it at a legislative hearing that just happened to be going on that next morning, and we sent that over with someone to explain and to say how to fast forward to the next segment, et cetera, and to explain what was going on. And when Brad Raffensperger first saw that, his explanation was, well, they were not really counting ballots. They were just processing, getting ready for the next day. Well, that's one of those, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? I mean, it's ridiculous that he would say that. But he didn't stop there. The next thing he said was that he had someone from his office there the entire time. But again, if you watch the video, you will see that between the time that the observers were all run out and the time and before, and they started counting again. They started processing ballots again about 10:25, 10:30 p.m. on election night. There's nobody else there until about 10 till midnight, about 11:50 p.m. And that's when, and supposedly the person who enters and then gets on the phone, that's supposedly somebody from Brad Raffensperger's office. But between 10:30 and 11:50, there was nobody there except those election workers running those ballots through. I am told it's a mother and daughter. But so his second explanation, after he figured out that, well, you probably, people watching that know that they're not just getting ready for the next day, they're actually counting ballots. And then the next thing he says is, oh, my person from my office was there the whole time. And then you can watch the video and see that that's not true. But his final explanation, which he said on 60 Minutes, he gave this interview and said this on 60 Minutes, was that final explanation was that we, being President Trump's legal team, that we had edited the tape. That we had edited the tape. Well, I'm here to tell you, I have watched all of that tape between 10 p.m. and between the time they started counting, stopped counting, and we didn't edit that at all. No, we did not show 14 hours of tape to the legislative hearing when we had 10 minutes. But that's what he said publicly. Now I want to read to you what his own report, his own monitor said about this very video. The state's chief election monitor stated that bringing ballots in through the back door on 11/5 was the wrong call for transparency purposes. That's 2 days later. They brought in ballots in the back door of the State Farm Arena and the warehouse where they were processing ballots. It said the monitor observed that this gave the impression to everyone, myself included, that they had found more ballots after the deadline. This is in the report of Raffensperger's own monitor. Incredibly, the report also concludes that the truth about what happened on the night of November 3rd between 10:30 p.m. and 11:52 p.m. at State Farm Arena, quote, continues to be elusive. But if the party poll watchers are correct about being told to leave, then there is a serious problem. Now, this is the monitor for the state, for Secretary of State Raffensperger. Does this sound to you like he believes that we edited the tape? No. This sounds to me like the state's Raffensperger's own monitor said there's a big problem here. I want to share one more thing about Brad Raffensperger. I could really talk about him for a whole podcast, and I might do that sometime because he's pretty terrible. But in December, on December 23rd, a group of citizens in Georgia filed a lawsuit claiming that their constitutional rights under the Georgia State Constitution had been violated by the conduct of the election, and in particular, that Fulton County and its disregard of state and federal law had compromised and had constituted a violation of their rights under to equal protection and due process under the Georgia Constitution. And this judge, Chris Brasher, finally appointed a judge to hear their case. I think he thought it was an election contest, but he appointed a judge who does not live in Fulton County, which is what he should have done in our election contest. And so that lawsuit has been allowed to continue. And this judge has ordered that the, and has allowed, it has not dismissed the case. That case is ongoing. And the judge allowed an inspection of all of the images of the ballots that were cast in Fulton County. It includes the and it includes the recount reports. And I just want to share with you some basic information that they've gotten so far in this lawsuit. And so this was, they were allowed to review the attorneys and the litigants, the plaintiffs were allowed to review the ballots and the ballot images. There are missing, when they were doing the recount, the ballots were put into batches of 100. There are 153 batches of ballots that are listed on the custodian report that they cannot find, that they have no idea where the ballot batches, where the ballots are. That's over 15,000 ballots missing. There are another 3,700 ballots that are clearly duplicates. You can tell that by just looking at the images. They're duplicates. There's a potential of counterfeit ballots. One of the things that was in our lawsuit, and which is in this lawsuit, is that there are thousands of ballots that some of the poll watchers began to notice were being processed through the tabulating machines that had never been folded. Well, if under Georgia law, to be a legal ballot, it has to be a mail ballot. It has to be put into an envelope and returned. And these were never folded, so they cannot possibly be legal ballots. We refer to those as the pristine ballots. And they've been looking for those ballots, and they appear to have been filled out by a printer rather than a pen and were never placed in envelopes. So the plaintiff's lawyers came back in, and the plaintiff said, Your Honor, we've looked at these images, but we really need to be able to examine the ballots themselves because we can't tell from the images whether or not they were folded. That we can bring in forensic investigators who can look, and they can tell, they can look at the ink, they can look at the paper, and they'll be able to tell. Well, guess what? Would you like to know who came in and urged the judge not to allow access to the original ballots and the original envelopes, the back of the envelopes? Well, none other than Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. And who was arguing on his behalf? The Attorney General of the state. Chris Carr, the Attorney General, sent somebody to argue on behalf of Brad Raffensperger not to allow the court or the plaintiffs to have access to inspect the original ballots and the original ballot envelopes. Now, Secretary of State Raffensperger is not a party to the Fulton County lawsuit. He's not even a friend of the court. He just asked to be heard. And the plaintiff said, fine, we want to hear what he has to say. And the judge allowed him to come in and to argue. Don't let these plaintiffs have access to the ballots. And for goodness sake, don't let them have access to the back of the envelopes. He told the court, which was erroneous, told the court that when people sign the back of the envelope, that their signature constitutes something called personal identifying information, which, of course, your signature is not. And they told the court under federal law that that was the way the federal law defined it, which is not true. So they're coming in, Brad Raffensperger and the Attorney General, Chris Carr, coming into a lawsuit. They're not even a party. They're not part of the lawsuit. And they're arguing to the judge not to let the plaintiffs, who are citizens like us and some of our key poll watchers who filed affidavits in our election contest, not to let them have access to the ballots. Well, the judge overruled them. And starting on September 20th, this year, we think that the judge has said he wants all the different motions to be heard on September 20th. He's going to rule on all of those. And hopefully then the forensic investigators will be allowed to come in and will be able to actually, will be able to start to get more information about what really happened in Fulton County. If you want to help support the financing of those forensic investigators, CPI has set up a specific donation capability. If you go to www.voterscount.org, www.voterscount.org. If you give money to that, at that site, all of that money will go to help pay these expenses in Georgia. So look, I mean, I could talk a lot more about Georgia, but one of the things I just want to give you an example of the kinds of things we're going to be talking about on the podcast. We're going to try to help you as citizens get organized to be involved in and a presence at election boards, just like parents all over the country are doing with school boards. We need to be present at the school, at the election board meetings. We need to have you as election officials, as poll watchers, researching what's going on in the election offices. And that's part of what our podcast is going to do. We're going to help train you on what things citizens can do to reclaim control over the elections. We're going to have a guest who's going to talk to us probably more than once about the $400 million that Mark Zuckerberg and his wife gave to an organization called the Center for Tech and Civic Life, which was then, it was used to turn election administration offices into Democrat voter turnout machines. And in violation of the Internal Revenue Code and in violation of state law, they were not administering the election. They were using it to gin up a Democratic turnout in key cities and counties and targeted states. So we're going to have guests talking about that because I believe that that literally changed the outcome of the election. And we're going to talk about Congress and the legislation that they've been trying to push down our throats all year. Basically, the Democrats in Congress want to take away our rights to control our elections at the local level, so that they can codify everything that they did in 2020 to make sure that citizens can have no impact at the local level. And we're going to be talking about the Department of Justice and what the Biden Department of Justice is doing to try to keep citizens from being engaged in the election process. It's quite frightening, but we're not going to let them intimidate us. Just because they think that they own the election offices and the leftist groups have infiltrated the election offices, we're going to take it back. We're going to take those election offices back. And we need you to help us. And I want you to we're going to be talking about all of that. So look, I mean, our goal at CPI is to build an election integrity infrastructure nationwide where citizens can be engaged and watching and knowing what's going on at your election offices. And we're going to retake our election system one county at a time all over America. And so I hope you'll tune in, subscribe to the podcast, whoscounting.us with Cleta Mitchell. Go to our website, whoscounting.us. That's WHOS counting.us. Sign up for the Election Integrity newsletter. Watch our blog. Send it to your friends. We have a lot of work to do and a lot of interesting people doing a lot of interesting things to save our country. And I hope that you'll be with us every week with Who's Counting. Thank you.